From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Stop me if you've heard this story before. A devout family sends their 9-year-old son to a religious institution. After a time, they discover the boy is being abused by one of the religious leaders. But rather than prosecuting the perpetrator, the crime is hushed up, and more children are put in danger. This cycle is familiar to anyone who has been following the abuse scandals in the Roman Catholic Church. But internationally, the physical and sexual abuse of children has also been a problem in Islamic schools. In many cases, stopping the abuse and bringing those responsible to justice has been just as challenging for some Muslim communities overseas as it has been for Catholics in the U.S. So on this edition of Global Journalist, we'll get a glimpse of some recent reporting on this problem in two very different areas of the world. In a few minutes, we'll turn to northern Nigeria, where a series of high-profile police raids on Islamic schools accused of abuse has brought a lot of focus on the treatment of the country's 10 million Islamic school students. But first, we're going to turn to Pakistan, where an Associated Press investigation from 2017 found that sexual abuse is a pervasive and long-running problem in that country's Islamic schools. So for more on this, we're going to bring in Kathy Gannon in Islamabad. She's the AP's chief correspondent for Pakistan and India. Kathy, welcome.
Thank you very much. Pakistan and Afghanistan. Thank you.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. Talk to us about how you got interested in doing this story.
Yeah, you know, you sort of hear rumors, and I had, of course, because of the scandal in the Catholic Church, and we thought, you know, along with our enterprise desk, that, you know, we should look into, you know, is this something that also happens in these religious schools where you have literally hundreds of boys in these schools that are like boarding houses and they live there? And so I just started making a few queries and looking at statistics and talking to people, and realized that it really was very pervasive, and wanted to try to tell the story and to tell the story from the children's point of view. So it took many months to get this story.
Well, you interviewed more than a dozen children or families of children who had reported abuse in Islamic schools. One of them was this 9-year-old boy named Parveen. Tell us what happened to him.
Yeah, it was really so sad, you know, because the poor little thing, it had happened to him. He'd come home. He didn't want to go back, but he couldn't tell his family what had happened. And so they kept insisting that he return, you know, and he didn't want to tell. And sometimes his older brothers would beat him and say, no, you have to go. And then when he was telling the story, his mother hadn't realized what he'd been going through and was just devastated. And they did arrest the religious instructor, the mullah, the cleric.
And well, I understand that you followed that through to trial. Parveen had been sexually abused, which is obviously sort of a taboo subject. But what ended up happening to the cleric who was accused of abusing him?
Yeah, well, this is it. The cleric actually, in the end, ended up getting off. He wasn't sentenced to jail, which is often the case. And also, it is really quite disturbing in some of these cases, and in many of these cases, are these militant groups that then try to intimidate the judges, intimidate the witnesses. At the courthouse of one case that I went to, there were some members of this militant group. And I didn't realize until after that they were there. Or, I mean, I didn't realize when I first went, but I realized as we were sitting there who they were. And they're very dangerous and very intimidating. And so they also frighten the families into not saying anything or into changing their story or withdrawing the charges. So it's a different layers that are involved that make it difficult for children and for the families of children to have these charges laid. And also, and just like in the Catholic Church, these children are religious leaders and very important people in their lives, and so also they don't know how to respond to it and how to tell their families that this is happening, and also they feel guilt, and then they feel shame, and then they're told not to say anything, and they're threatened. So it's really torturous for these children.
And I mean, you raise this issue of the Roman Catholic Church scandals in the U.S. and some parallels there as well. But talk to us in Pakistan about how the police handle these cases.
Sure. It's very difficult to get the police to act on these cases, in many of the cases. Sometimes because there is a level of corruption within the police, they're bribed or they're paid not to do anything. But also there's a feeling that you can't go after the religious people, and they really, to take that step to actually go after a religious person and to lay a charge and to put them in jail is a huge thing for them to do, and so they often ignore the cases unless they're really the family is really insistent, and the investigation is minimal, and the effort that's put in is limited. So that's the other half of the equation is even once the child finally tells his story and his family wants to do something, then you have to get the police to actually go ahead and do something about it and to actually arrest the cleric.
Well, to be clear, I mean, obviously, like, there are many different madrasas in Pakistan, and certainly not all of them are involved in abuse or sexual abuse, but it sounds like there also is perhaps a tolerance that the children will have sort of a harsh life in some ways at the madrasas, that they will be, you know, very disciplined in strict ways.
Well, I mean, there is that level of strictness that's in the madrasas, and that sort of, as you so rightly say, is an acceptable expectation among the families. But also, the vast majority of the kids that are in these madrasas are from the poorest, and so they get fed, they get kept there, so it's room, board, and they go home maybe on the weekends. So this is also, it's a very difficult choice for their families to make, because they can't afford to send them to school. They don't have the money for the books and that, so they send them to these madrasas. And you're absolutely right. It isn't in every madrasa, just as it isn't in every Catholic parish. And it's certainly in the Catholic Church. It's not just in the United States. It's around the world that these incidences and thousands of them have occurred. So, I mean, it's a real phenomena how these religious leaders are getting away with this abuse of brutalizing of children. So, it's a real disturbing phenomenon, and it certainly is very prevalent within these schools, and just as it is in the Catholic Church. And I'm not sure how you explain that, to tell you the truth.
Well, Kathy Gannon, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you very much for having me.
A reminder that this is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the problem of child abuse in Islamic schools overseas, an issue that has some parallels to the sex abuse scandals that have rocked both the Roman Catholic Church and the Southern Baptist Convention in the U.S. And we just heard about the problem in Pakistan from Kathy Gannon of the Associated Press. Up next, we're going to turn to West Africa. There, this issue has been making headlines in Nigeria, after a series of police raids released about 1,000 people, mostly children. They'd reportedly been held in inhumane conditions in institutions that were nominally Islamic schools, but in reality, more like detention centers. Some had been victims of sexual abuse and even torture. So for more on this, we're going to bring in Maini Jones. She's a Nigeria correspondent for BBC News. She joins us now from Lagos. Maini, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Jason.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Start out maybe just by talking about Islamic schools in northern Nigeria. It sounds like they play a number of different roles within society there. What are those?
Yeah, so Islamic schools in northern Nigeria are one of the primary sources of education in the region. The north of the country tends to be predominantly Muslim, where southern Nigeria tends to be predominantly Christian. And there are some estimates that put the number of children attending Islamic schools in northern Nigeria at about 10 million. So they're really influential. They're a big source of education, but they also, some of them form double up as rehabilitation centers for people with drug addictions, as well as reform centers for young people that may be truant, may have behavioral problems. And also some of them may serve as places to take mentally ill patients. So not only did they provide a religious education, but they also have this slightly reform reform center. They also act as a reform center.
Well, the police carried out a series of raids in several different states in Nigeria over the past month. Tell us what they found.
Yeah, so the first one of these was in late September. The police found about 300 people in a school or rehabilitation center in the city of Kaduna, which is one of the biggest cities in northern Nigeria. These people were found in chains. There was a mixture of adults and children being kept together in the same facility. And when the police interviewed them, they said that they had been abused, they'd been prevented from leaving the center, that they were sexually molested by the people running the center, and often starved. And over the next 6 weeks, the police carried out a number of other raids across Kaduna City, but also in western Nigeria, in the state of Kwara, in Katsina in the north, and in southern Nigeria, including in the country's biggest city, Lagos, showing that the problem was prevalent right across the country.
Well, you visited one of these institutions that was raided in a town called Dora in northern Nigeria, I understand. This is actually the hometown of President Buhari. What did you see there?
Yes, I was saying Daura is a relatively small town compared to a bigger city like Kaduna. The center we went to was a Quranic and rehabilitation center, and conditions there were pretty horrible. It was a very small building. There was a courtyard in the middle of the building, and it was surrounded by about five or six very small dark cells. They had bars on the windows and doors. The floor was completely littered with bedding, soiled clothes, rotting food. And we spoke to some victims there who told us that about 40 men and boys would be kept in one of those tiny cells, that they would be chained, that they would be forced to urinate and defecate in the same place where they ate and slept, and that they were often taken out into the courtyard by the malam that ran the school and by some of the teachers to be physically and sexually abused.
Do you have a sense as to why these police raids took place now? I mean, as you describe this happening across the country, these schools are fairly large. I mean, there must have been some sense that people knew what was going on to some extent.
Yeah, it was interesting because visiting that center in Daura, but we also visited one in the city of Katsina, which is about an hour's drive from Daura. They are in residential areas, densely populated areas. And we were told by both former students and neighbors that the pupils would often be taken outside of the school to receive their religious education. They're quite cramped buildings, so there wasn't always space for them to be taught within the walls of the school. So neighbors saw them and were aware of them. But speaking to some of the neighbors, when we asked them why didn't they report the conditions to the police, they said they'd see these young men in chains. They said that the men running the centers are very influential. In the case of the gentleman in Dara, they said he had big connections in the business community and big connections politically as well, and was wealthy. These schools are not cheap. Parents, we were told, in the case of Dara, were paying about $80 a month to send their children there, which is a lot of money in the area. So many of the neighbors were too scared to act, and they thought that the police might not do anything about it because these men were so well connected.
Well, give us just a sense as to what the overall government response has been. Is there a move towards more systematic regulation of these?
The government's reaction has been quite muted. There was a statement issued by the presidency in late October condemning the conditions in those centers. The statement said that no sensible democratic government would tolerate the detention and the abuse of young people in the name of rehabilitation. But we haven't seen any evidence or any concrete measures being put in place to actually deal with the problem. A report came out this week by Human Rights Watch looking at the way people were meant mental illnesses were being treated in similar centers across the country. And they commended the government for closing down and raiding these centers, but they also said that more needed to be done for the victims, that psychosocial support needed to be provided, that they needed to have access to social services. And the government hasn't outlined any policies or plan to try and help these victims beyond closing down the centers. There aren't enough rehabilitation centers for people with behavioral problems or drug addictions in the country. There are some state facilities, but they're not big enough. And it's not quite clear that the government has a plan to build any more or offer any more support to families that desperately need this help.
Humayuni Jones, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about the issue of physical and sexual abuse of children in Islamic schools overseas, a problem with many similarities to the Catholic Church abuse scandals in the U.S. So for more on the role that these Islamic schools play in northern Nigeria, as well as some of the issues that may have fostered these abusive situations, we're going to bring in two other experts. Joining us from the city of Lincoln in the U.K. is Hadiza Abdulrahman. She's a lecturer at Bishop Grosseteste University who researches these schools. Hadiza, welcome.
Thank you.
And also with us from the Nigerian capital, Abuja, is Mohammed Sabo. He's a team lead for the Al-Majri Child Rights Initiative, a group that advocates for Islamic school students. Mohammed, welcome.
Thank you, Jason, for having me.
Well, Mohammed, let me start with you. You've talked, your organization has been working on the issue of child rights in these Islamic schools, referred to as Al-Majris in northern Nigeria, well before these raids exposed this kind of abuse. Are you surprised at what the police have found?
Okay, thank you very much once again for having me. Like I've said previously in other space, I'm not surprised at what the police have found in the centers. They are clear manifestation of what the centers look like across the country, as we have seen. They are indeed what the children also face across the country. So I'm not in any way surprised by the recent revelation that we see in these centers. And just like Mayoni said, many people within the country knows about these centers. They know how the children live. I mean, these children, besides those that are in the building, we see some of them outside, you know, in even worse condition. So I'm not in any way surprised with the revelation we have seen.
Well, Hadiza Abdulrahman, if I could bring you in, you've talked about how this system of Islamic schools, it often doesn't make sense to foreigners, to outsiders, but in fact, they do play a really important role in people's lives in northern Nigeria. For an American, for someone from the UK who may never have been to this part of the world, why would these seem strange?
They would seem strange because we don't understand the context within which they exist. We don't understand the role that they play in the northern Nigerian society as it is. I always say that when you're looking at Quranic schools like this, you need to understand the Nigerian context. Schools like this and the things that have been uncovered can really only happen because of the context within which they exist, because of what I call societal failures in many ways. And they're a microcosm of the Nigerian society. So whatever is happening in Al-Majri schools is also happening in the wider society. And that's what I keep bringing people back to. These things are not unique to these schools at all. That's what happens in homes, in police stations, in Western-style schools, and other establishments all across Nigeria.
Well, you raise a good point there, but Mohammed Sabo, if I could turn this to you, give us just a sense as to what the daily life is for the average student, the average Al-Majri, as you refer to them. What's it like for them? What do they do?
So I, in this regard, I would like to disagree with Hadiza a bit. You know, for me, if we are to solve the problem that is associated with these children, we need to be transparent in our communication. We need to be able to differentiate and at least and say the reality of what things are. The reality of these children in these schools, beside what we see that they are being confined in such places, what about those we see begging on the street every day before they eat? What about those we see exposed to abuse and dangers? What about those we see being used for child labor and all that? So it's not enough for us to say that We have such kind of situation in other aspects, and then this should be justified. No, okay, we condemn that as well, but then whatever is happening here, we should also be able to do what we can to, you know, reform it, to make it such in a way that we give it a human face. None of us who have children or little ones want to see them in the condition of those children. So whatever education they are having, whatever, nobody's against that, but we should be able to have a best practice that will ensure that is that their fundamental children's right is being enhanced and is being protected. If it is the fault of the government, then we as citizens need to hold the government accountable and ensure that the right things are done in terms of provision of infrastructure and other. And I quite agree with the fact that a lot of parents send their children to these schools because they see it as an alternative. Indeed, everybody knows that the formal or conventional schools are not available in these villages, and that's why most parents see this and then send them send their children to this school. So that is agreed. But whatever we see it, however we see it, the human right violation, the children right violation, where these children are exposed in the way and manner we see them, must be something that should concern all of us. And for me, it should be the central focus of our discussion.
Well, Mohammed, let me stop you there, because I think you raise a number of different points there, and I want to let Hadiza respond to them. But you raise this one aspect of child begging, which is a way that which is a feature of many Islamic schools in northern Nigeria, is that the students, quite young, 8, 9, 10 years old, they go out with bowls and they beg to support themselves for food or for money. And they are taught classical Arabic scriptures, the Quran, and are not taught math and science and reading in English. And so I don't think anyone here is condoning the abuse that's taking place. But Hadiza, if you want to pick up on this.
I think there's a misunderstanding here. I wasn't in any way condoning. I was trying to explain. And what I'm trying to say is you cannot understand how these things happen for as long as they do. If you do not understand the wider context within which they exist, what allows it to happen is what I'm saying. What systemic failures allow it to happen? That's the point I'm bringing us back to. If children are begging on the streets, that cannot be right. Under any ramifications, who is taking responsibility for that? We live in a country that does not know how many Quranic schools exist. We have a guesstimate of how many boys are in this system. People send their children to these schools because they have no choice, because they think it's suitable, they think it's available for various reasons. What the state can do is to try regulating, to try reforming, but really to move past platitudes and do something about it. I'm saying that we need to understand the wider context, systemic failures and systemic issues that allow these schools to exist in the way that they do.
Yeah, and Mohammed, if I could turn this to you. Hadiza raises some good points here. I mean, there was a story by Reuters earlier this year. It was actually about Senegal and Guinea-Bissau, but there's a similar Islamic school system there as in northern Nigeria, I understand. And in fact, there was an aid agency that went and rescued a bunch of children who went to an Islamic school but were forced to beg on the streets of Dakar in Senegal to support themselves. So this aid agency rescued them and returned them to their home villages, but their parents were upset. They basically didn't want their children to be rescued and were basically saying, like, we preferred them to be in the Islamic school because it's better than the alternative that they have in the village. I mean, certainly you can see that point of view.
Mm-hmm. So I absolutely agree with Hadiza on the point that she raised about systemic failure. And for me, that has been the central focus of our advocacy. It's about governance. You know, failures of governance in all ramifications, in terms of failures to use the state resources for the benefit of the poor, in terms of also using the state resources and capacity to enforce the laws where necessary. So however you look at it, indeed, it's the failures of governance and all that. And it's first of all, we need to be able to indeed hold government accountable to demand that these schools be available for these children where they come from, and so that they don't see a school that violates their rights and as an alternative. And but in other in relation to what you say about some parents in Senegal, we all know that the state has responsibility and obligation to protect children from abuse, exploitation, even while in care of their own parent. So even if parents they are hesitant to, you know, to protect the right to stop their children from begging in the manner we see, the state has the responsibility to protect the children from it. But first, the state needs to also be able to hold up to its responsibility in ensuring that these schools are available, and then the social welfare that are needed to support these children in this school are made available. And
well, I think this certainly makes sense, Mohammed. But let me move this back to Hadiza because our time is growing short. Hadiza, I mean, if you could highlight one thing that is misunderstood about these schools by outsiders, what would it be?
Everything. So I looked at something I call the dominant discourses. I think even in our manner of looking at this system at the issue, we lose sight of what meaning it holds for the people who send their children there, and we approach it from the perspective of another meaning making. So for me, it's about meaning making with the best of intentions, with all our solutions. If we do not understand the relevance of this system, the meanings these people hold for the practitioners, we keep getting it wrong. And that's what I keep getting people back to: understand the reason that people send their children. Understand the reason that people still send their children to the foot of the Malam. We might be Western schooled, and that means that changes our way of viewing what education is. But do we truly know that education for them means different things? That these people are trying to make the best in a country that has given them so little, and yet we come back and we scapegoat them for everything. So for me, the biggest misconception is that it leads to people becoming Boko Haram, the known state Islamist terrorist group. There's this belief that former Al-Majre end up being Boko Haram members, and that for me is by far the biggest misconception. The most correct narrative for me would be as a matter of child's right concerns. It's disturbing that children have to beg. It's disturbing that children have to live like that. And that should be where our focus is. So with that, I agree with Mohammed.
No, I mean, I think what you say makes a lot of sense, particularly given that something like only half of children in northern Nigeria are in formal primary schools. And if you have a child with addiction or psychiatric issues, there aren't other institutions that deal with this.
The investigative eye looked at this program, and it's where it went to a government-funded rehab center, and they found people shackled even in a government-owned rehabilitation center. Well, so when I say this is widespread, you find the same. We have what I call a prayer economy. And these are Murray Last's words. A prayer economy is where you go to churches and clerics, Muslim clerics, for ministration, for healing, for everything. This is the society within which it exists. People prefer to go to malams and pastors rather than go to hospitals.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. But you raise a number of great points, Hadiza.
Thank you so much.
As I mentioned, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Kathy Gannon, Myeni Jones, Mohammed Sabuk, and Hadiza Abdulrahman for taking the time to join us. Our assistant producers this week are Charles Dranguinis and Samantha Wagan. Trevor Hook is our supervising producer, and Kyle McCubbin is visual editor. Takiya Thomas is audio engineer. Kathy Kiley is executive editor. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.